The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the head of Human Rights Watch for Israel and the surrounding Arab areas, Bill Van Esveld. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's now officially the new month of Elul, final month of the Jewish year, which means it's less than 4 weeks till Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year of 5771. As a rabbi, I can assure you that this seems much, much too soon. You know, Elul is both my favorite and least favorite month of the Jewish calendar year. It's filled with beautiful ways to remind us about what really matters in our lives. Rituals like blowing the shofar every day, special prayers that reconnect us to God, customs of repair and apology that help us get closer to our family and friends. The loveliest tradition about the month of Elul has to do with its very name in Hebrew, which is used as an acronym for a beautiful verse in the book Song of Songs from the Bible, Ani l'dodi v'dodi li. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, spelling Elul, the letters of love. Great stuff. Excellent month, Elul. On the other hand, as Tevye would say, Elul means that the High Holy Days are right around the corner. This is like coming through a tunnel and seeing that the light ahead of you is a train. As a rabbi and cantor, this establishes it's going to be the busiest, most highly pressured period of the whole year. The temple is going full speed, day and night. The largest, most demanding, and highest expectation services of the year are coming. Our congregational music has to be at its best. It's the hardest, most complicated stuff we do. Sermons are expected to be groundbreaking, soul-inspiring, even earth-shaking, or at least mildly entertaining. The pressure builds all through the month. 3 weeks till Rosh Hashanah, 2 weeks, 1 week, 4 days. It's all too much. In a way, it summarizes the human condition. Those things that are really good for us are often the most challenging, and we don't really feel like doing them. Elul comes to remind us and persuade us that recovering our relationships with those we love, with those we respect, with God, is the most important work of all, the best. And so, to play us in on this first Sunday in the month of Elul, we continue our preview of High Holy Day music with a personal favorite of mine, Tika B'Shofar Gadol, sound the great shofar, the ram's horn of freedom throughout the world.
Tika, Tika B'Shofar Gadol L'Herutenu Mesames, Mesames L'Kabez Galuyotenu Bekamtenu Yaha Mehera, Mehera Mea Bakan Kotar Etz Mea Tzenu
Tika Shofar gadol lecheirutenu v'sa v'sanes v'sanes v'kabet galuyotenu v'kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
me'ar batan fotaret v'yatzeinu Tika
Oh,
vekabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
ve'arbatan fotaret ve'yatzeinu
Sayno yahan mehera mehera mehar bakan fotares leyatse.
Tekabe Shofar, sung by Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, who will be here in Tucson for the High Holy Days at Temple Emmanuel, by the way, heralding the coming new year, September 8th and 9th. Moving on, this morning we'll have one of the most articulate guests we have ever entertained on Too Jewish, the Human Rights Watch head of its Jerusalem operations, Bill Van Esveld. Find out what the watchdog agency really thinks about Palestinians and Israelis when we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism celebrates its 10th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in new locations. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment's easy. Just call 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism is an exciting learning opportunity for anyone curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free, but you do need to pre-enroll by calling 327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, while introducing the new Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with the rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. Call Mila Anderson at 520-327-4501.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of people tell you how important breakfast is, but I think lunch is better. Look at it this way. When you go to lunch, you get to take a break from work. With breakfast, you're just taking a break from sleep. Another great thing about lunch, and this is important, Mama's Pizza is open for lunch, and we're not open for breakfast. So you can drop in at lunchtime and get a slice, a whole pie, or one of our delicious calzones. You can even get a piece of Mama's famous home-baked cheesecake for dessert. You can't do that at breakfast. Mama's has the perfect lunch atmosphere. We designed Mama's to be comfortable enough for a business meeting and casual enough for any group of friends. So try Mama's for your next lunch. Then, if you got any leftovers, save them for breakfast. Mama's Pizza, with 4 convenient locations, including our newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Bill Van Esveld. Bill is the Human Rights Watch researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, which we'll discuss in a moment. He's based in Jerusalem, got a degree from the University of Toronto, went to New York University Law School, where he was a fellow at the Institute for International Law and Justice. He has had a variety of important research fellowships and has been reporting on human rights in Algeria African asylum seekers in both Egypt and Israel, and migrant workers' rights in the United Arab Emirates before taking on this new task. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about, just sort of off the cuff, the Hamas morality police that you've written about in some recent newspaper articles?
Well, Hamas have just been pretty much a disaster for the personal freedoms of the people who are living in Gaza. And it's reached the point now where it's not just annoyances like you can't go to the beach and go swimming if you're a woman, or, you know, there are people pressuring you to put on the headscarf if you go to school if you're a woman. It's really become something at the level of it's hard for a couple to walk down the street because they're likely to be stopped by a policeman who will demand to know whether they're married, and sometimes won't accept anything short of a marriage certificate for proof that they're married. He will separate the couple. He'll take one of you off to one side of the street and ask you questions like, what's your grandmother's name? What's your grandfather's name? Okay, stay here. Then he'll go over to your partner and ask them these sorts of questions to prove whether they really know what your grandmother or grandfather's name are, to see whether you're really legit. And this is just going on all the time and has, led to incidents of torture, arbitrary detention in some cases. So things are pretty unfortunate.
Human Rights Watch has a responsibility within its charter of reporting really everything that they find. It has a reputation sometimes among some Jewish groups for reporting only bad things about Israel. But how do you see that responsibility, and how does it play out living as you do in Israel, reporting on Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, we're not popular anywhere we work, and we work in about 80 different countries around the world.
It's sort of like being Jewish, actually. You know?
Our job is basically to criticize governments or the people who are in power and take on the responsibilities of a government like Hamas in Gaza. So we criticize Israel on the same basis and the same grounds that we criticize the United States or Canada or, you know, the UK or anyone else. So it's really only going to be bad news from us about whatever country you happen to be speaking about. But what we try and be very, very careful about, especially considering that we are aware that Israel faces a serious campaign of delegitimization, is that we want to be very clear that we do not criticize the state of Israel. We do not criticize the Israeli government per se. We only criticize individual policies of the Israeli government that are in violation of its human rights obligations. And we get on our high horse and talk about human rights obligations only insofar as the government has voluntarily signed up for them by ratifying a human rights treaty. So Israel has, to its credit, ratified the main human rights treaties. It is, you know, voluntarily pledged to uphold certain human rights for the people it controls. And that's the standard that we want to hold Israel up to. It's, you know, the standard it's voluntarily signed up to, the same way we do in other countries.
We will talk much more on the fascinating question of human rights in the Middle East and elsewhere with Bill Van Esvelt of Human Rights Watch when we return on Too Jewish This Morning.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. One of the great experiences in Jewish life is the privilege and pleasure of seeing a new Torah completed. The Linda Nadel Centennial Torah of Temple Emmanuel, celebrating the 100th anniversary year of Arizona's first Jewish congregation, will reach its Siyum dedication ceremony on Sunday, August 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Temple Emmanuel. During this unique celebration, the scribe of the Torah scroll, Rabbi Shmuel Miller, we'll fill in the final letters of the centennial Torah on the last section of parchment in Deuteronomy, the final book of the Torah. It's a dramatic, amazing moment. There'll be lots of celebratory music and ceremony and refreshments for all. This once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see the writing of a new Torah completed is open to everyone at no charge. For more information, call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501. Temple is located at 225 North Country Club Road, near Broadway. Join us for the Centennial Torah Siyum on Sunday, August 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel and the Tucson Hebrew Academy are proud to introduce a great new learning opportunity for the whole family, the Taste of Judaism Family Class, Sundays, August 15th, 22nd, and 29th at 1 p.m. At the Taste of Judaism Family Class, adults enjoy an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, led by Temple Emmanuel's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Jason Holtz. Meanwhile, kids enjoy their own fun program of Jewish stories, crafts, and activities. Call 327-4501 to sign up. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish food. The sessions are free and open to all, Jewish or not. Taste of Judaism, celebrating its 10th year as the most successful outreach program in the country, welcomes you. Isn't it time you came? In addition to the family class at THA, Taste of Judaism sessions are offered in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson. Call Mila at 327-4501 for more information and to register today for the Taste of Judaism family class.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through their website or downloading us from twojewishradio.com or at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. You know, sometimes here on Too Jewish, we report the passing of an important historical figure, or a great rabbi, or a theologian, or a politician. Today is not like that. Today I need to tell you about a man who was a quiet hero, and quite a hero. It's a mostly forgotten story that should be retold, both because it's great, and because it reminds us of a time and place. Israel between the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War from 67 to 73, as it approached its 25th birthday, when dangerous but amazing things happen regularly and everything suddenly seemed possible. Reginald Levy was captain of a hijacked Belgian airliner in 1972. He died last week in Dover, England at the age of 88. But there's a lot to this one. The story goes like this. Sabina, flight 571 from Brussels to Tel Aviv, was 20 minutes out of Vienna on May 8, 1972, when four Arabs waving pistols rushed the cockpit. "As you can see," Captain Levy calmly told the 90 passengers, "we have friends aboard." The friends were members of Black September, a terrorist organization that grew out of the Palestinian defeat in the 1970 Jordanian Civil War. It would be responsible for murdering 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team in Munich 4 months later. These hijackers, two men and two women, ordered Captain Levy to land at Lod Airport, later called Ben-Gurion, where they threatened to blow up the plane unless 317 Palestinian guerrillas were released from Israeli prisons. Might not have been the smartest idea, hijacking the plane to Israel, but that's what they did. Within an hour of the radio message from Captain Levy reporting the hijacking, Israel's defense minister, Moshe Dayan, was at the airport. After dark that day, Israeli agents crept under the parked plane, deflated the tires, and disconnected the hydraulics. At the hijackers' request, International Red Cross teams were summoned to carry messages between the plane and Moshe Dayan. After presenting their demands, the hijackers were alarmed to discover they could not take off again. Captain Levy started a conversation to calm them down, and he kept on chatting throughout the night. "I talked about everything under the sun," he said later, "from navigation to sex." It worked. The hijackers did not immediately blow up the plane and the 100 passengers, but the threat remained. Next morning, to demonstrate their intentions, the hijackers actually sent Captain Levy to the terminal with a sample of the explosives they had on board. He told the Israelis much more, described the hijackers, their positions, and the black bags in which they were carrying explosives. He also told them significantly that there were no seats blocking the emergency doors. Moshe Dayan promised the hijackers he would repair the plane and bring the Palestinian prisoners to the airport. And so, Israeli troops dressed up as prisoners were shown to the hijackers from a distance. Another plane was taken out to a runway, supposedly to fly them to Cairo. Twenty-one hours after Captain Levy's plane had been hijacked, two trucks carrying 18 guys in white overalls drove up to the jetliner. They milled about the plane, supposedly checking tires and other equipment. Suddenly, they ripped open the emergency exits above the wings and opened fire inside the cabin. The fusillade from the guys in overalls, in reality members of the elite commando unit Sayeret Matkal, ended within 90 seconds, a minute and a half. The commandos were led by Ehud Barak, today Israel's defense minister and a former prime minister and a guest on Too Jewish, and among the commandos was Benjamin Netanyahu, now Israel's prime minister. The two male hijackers who had returned fire were killed. Two woman hijackers were captured. Several passengers were wounded, but none died. Tearful passengers and crew members slid off the wings and were bussed to a terminal in the arms of ecstatic relatives. A few days later, Prime Minister Golda Meir held a dinner for those involved in the rescue. She kissed Captain Levy and cried, "We love you." The hijacking actually took place on Captain Reginald Levy's 50th birthday. His wife was on board. They were going to celebrate in Tel Aviv. Although the hijacking was his shining moment on the world stage, it was by no means his only one. Captain Levy joined the Royal Air Force, the RAF, when he was just 18. He flew bombing missions over Germany in World War II and was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. After the war, he took part in the Berlin Airlift and later joined Sabena as an airline pilot. He retired in 1982 to raise 4 children, 9 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. There's one more footnote to this story. In 2007, just 3 years ago, Eliezer Sachs, one of the Israeli commandos back in 72, arrived at the offices of the Jerusalem Post newspaper and handed Captain Levy's daughter, then an editorial assistant at the paper, the blue Sabena captain's cap her father had left on the plane. He gave her a letter he'd written to Captain Reginald Levy. "I want to apologize for the long time, 35 years, that I forgot to give your hat back," it said. "I hope the hat'll find its way back to your head." It did. You know, there was a time when anything seemed possible in Israel, good and bad. May the memory of this fine man, Captain Reginald Levy, and this great story live long. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Too Jewish storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with a great restaurateur, Janos Weidler of Janos Restaurant and the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So what's going on this summer at Janos and the J-Bar?
We've got so much going on, it's hard for me to keep it all straight, but I'm going to try. We've got our summer music series that you know about. We have our summer passports where you dine, and the more times you dine, you collect stamps for free dinners at Janos or J-Bar. Our Janos summer samplers at $19.95, our J-Bar summer samplers at $12.95. At Janos, our 10 terrific taste menu, 4 courses, 12 different items for $50, drink specials, wine specials. Summer's our time.
I'm starving.
Well, come on over, Rabbi.
What's the phone number for Janos and the J-Bar?
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com. We've got all our menus up. We've got the summer music schedule up.
And don't forget all the great samplers. We will see you at Janos and the J-Bar, J-A-N-O-S.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique,
Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The South American Jewish community, particularly Argentina, has popped in the news a lot the last several years, almost a flavor of the month for certain kinds of trips from federations and others. Interesting country, interesting Jewish community.
You know, it is interesting that North American Jewry seems to have belatedly taken note of the fact that there is a huge and important Jewish community in Argentina. Just at the moment that that community is sort of starting to close up shop in a way. I mean, between the political crises and the financial crises and various other crises in Argentina over the past couple decades, a lot of Jews there have left for other countries, notably the U.S. and Israel, although not exclusively, in some cases to other countries in Latin America. So it's a shrinking Jewish community, but I mean, I know a kid who was a freshman at Tulane this past year, and his Hillel chapter went to Buenos Aires over Pesach and celebrated the Seders there and then helped build houses for the poor and various federation trips, you know, men, women, seniors, juniors, young leaders, whatever, from all over the country are doing similar things. One could ask the question of why now, why so late? But, you know, when I was a kid and I went to Camp Ramah a million years ago, we looked at the world map of Camps Ramah, and the only three not in the U.S. were in Canada, Argentina, and Sweden. So the conservative movement has obviously had a major presence in Argentina for quite a while. I know that in the old days, a lot of the original Jewish settlers were Orthodox Jews from Eastern Europe, and in the intervening years, if not decades, a lot of the Jews who settled in Argentina became Reformed Jews. So all three of the major branches of North American Jewry can be found there to this day. The role they play in Argentine society is a little bit different from the role they play here, as I'm sure you know.
You know, I was going to say, to add on to that, the conservative movement founded a seminary there, Rabbi Marshall Meyer of blessed memory, who later founded B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue and revived it in New York. I worked with him a long time ago in Los Angeles, and he founded a seminary there that has trained many Argentinian conservative rabbis and conservative cantors in particular, who have, you can almost say, a dominant rising role in the conservative clergy in America. So a very important Jewish community in some interesting ways.
Right. And when I was in the world headquarters of the World Union of Jewish Students in the mid-70s, the, I don't know, third-ranking guy in the organization was a guy from Buenos Aires.
Right.
So this community has played an important role, I think, mostly post-Holocaust. I don't think that the Argentinian Jewish community was a major force before the Holocaust, but it was a place that a lot of European Jews found refuge after the war.
Right, and, you know, unlike the stereotype of a Sephardic community, really an Ashkenazi community primarily in Argentina.
Largely, yeah.
We will continue to talk maybe about some other Latin American Jewish communities next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benny the dentist has just finished treating one of his beautiful women patients. As she leaves the office, he turns to his assistant and says, "There goes the woman I love more than anyone in the world." "So why don't you marry her?" asks his assistant. "I wish I could," replies Benny. "I can't afford to. She happens to be my best patient." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a toothsome one, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. I grew up in Dallas at this Jewish school, Solomon Schechter, where the rabbi, while I was a child there, was Rabbi Ed Feinstein, a wonderful storyteller. And I imagine that I have a lot of subconscious influence from his storytelling on me. And he recently came out with a book about all just a collection of Jewish stories. And I found a few that I really liked in there. And one of them is about a king who was beloved by his people, wise and just and everything. But he was old. And before he died, he wrote down on a piece of paper who his successor would be. And he sealed it in an envelope and gave it to his advisor, told him only to open it 1 week after he had passed away. And so eventually he did die, and there was much grieving amongst everyone in the kingdom. And finally, the week passed, and the advisor opened the envelope only to discover that the king had named the court jester. Everyone was shocked. I mean, the court jester? Even he was more shocked than anyone else. He was hopping from foot to foot. He didn't know what to make of this. But there the robes were placed on his shoulders, and the pointy, funny belled hat on his head was taken off, and a crown was placed on in its stead, and he was king there. Well, at first it was rather awkward. People came to him, and he would tell them jokes and sing funny songs, and eventually, he kind of eased into his role based on his observations of the king before him. And you know, as the months turned into years, and the years turned into more years and decades, he became an incredible king, as good as the king before him. But there was this one strange thing about him. He would every now and then disappear from his duties, and he would go into this room in the back of the palace that he alone had a key for, and he would be locked away in there for hours at a time, and no one knew what he did. Well, one day an ambassador from a far-off land came to the palace to be the representative of his land to this king, and he befriended the king. He really liked him. He really respected him. He was especially struck with how well the king listened to everyone who came to him, great and small alike. But he wondered what the secret of the king was in this room, the secret that he had heard whispered amongst the servants. And so he followed the king one day. And when the king locked himself in the room, that ambassador peeked through the keyhole, and he saw the king take off his royal robes, put on the outfit of the jester, and dance and jump and sing around the room, doing cartwheels, telling jokes, and finally standing before the mirror, looking at himself and saying, "Always remember. Remember who you are. You are not a king. You are just a jester, a fool pretending to be a king. Always remember." And when the ambassador saw this, he was struck. He understood the source of the king's humility, why he listened so well. And he swore never to reveal the secret, and never did he, until as an old man, the two of them were sitting, best of friends, and he admitted what he had done, that he had seen the king's secret, and he told him he had never told anyone about it, nor would he ever, but there was one thing he was wondering. "How was it," he asked, "that the king before you knew that you would make such a good king yourself?" And the current king, the fool disguised as a king, grinned, and he said, "What do you think the last king was before he was king?"
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another tale next week. And now a word of Torah. Well, what are the most important laws in the world? Our weekly portion of Ki Tetzeh in Deuteronomy obligates us to ask this question. It's filled with an array of laws, rules, and ordinances affecting every aspect of life. They range from rules limiting unorthodox ritual practices to rules limiting conduct in wartime, from personal morality to behavior in society. Family laws are established about marriage, inheritance, divorce. Tort laws on damages are instituted, giving moral and financial responsibility to property owners. Laws of kindness decree human decency. Lots and lots of laws, some obscure, some famous. In short, reading Ki Tetzeh, our Torah portion, is interesting but dry. Some of the legislation is even outdated, clearly irrelevant. But two sets of related laws established in Ki Tetzeh alone would guarantee its place in the highest of moral realms of all documents. Both put into practical terms what the Torah has already stressed. When a person is in your power economically, you must not exploit his weakness. The first of these rules states that if you take as pledge an item of clothing from a poor person, you have to return it to him before nightfall. In other words, you must not allow an impoverished man or woman to spend the night without proper clothing or shelter. This is a necessary reminder in our society, which tolerates homelessness in a manner that the much poorer world of the Bible's time would not. The second law states unequivocally and memorably that you must pay a worker on the day he completes his labor. In our own American society, delays of 2 weeks and more are common for payroll, even for minimum wage employees who need the money most. Again, the Torah insists on a higher standard of morality for employers than we do. Labor has value, and honest work deserves immediate pay. It's a simple lesson, but one we still haven't quite learned. In an era in which employers demand wage concessions, actually pay cuts for the same work, while they steadily cut benefits and jobs, perhaps it's time to allow Ki Teitzeh to teach us that once again. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, Bill Van Esvelt of the watchdog NGO Human Rights Watch will give us their scorecard on how Israel is doing. I promise you will be surprised at many of his observations when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The philanthropic world was titillated last week when 40 members of the world's wealthy elite, including 13 Jews, announced they would give away more than half their money before they died. The participating philanthropists were responding to a challenge issued earlier this year by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, who are not Jewish, to their billionaire peers to donate more than half their wealth in their lifetimes. Buffett and Gates call it the Giving Pledge. The immediate response in the Jewish world was odd in a bizarre but predictable way. In fact, it reminded me about the ancient joke about everything. Fine, we invented the computer, but will it be good for the Jews? Max Charndorf is the president of the Jewish Funders Network, an organization for people who give at least $25,000 annually to Jewish causes. Addressing this remarkable event, this Gates, Buffett, big donor thing, he said, "This pledge is a very good thing. I want to be clear about that, but I remain unsure if it is a game changer for the Jewish community in particular." After all, said Charndorf, the average Jewish billionaire gives pretty much the way all Americans give. If that's the case, we will see the money go to higher education, healthcare, and possibly the arts, he said, noting a phenomenon that long has vexed the Jewish philanthropic world. Wealthy Jews are among the most charitable mega-donors per capita, more than a third of living donors who have given away more than $1 billion, according to Forbes, are Jewish. That's a wild figure. But the overtly Jewish charities among their portfolios pale in comparison to the general causes to which they give. Mega philanthropists who have made Jewish causes a centerpiece of their giving are a big exception. Of course, anyone like Charndorf who can say something about the average Jewish billionaire is living in a very different world than the one you or I inhabit. Look, okay. As rabbi of a synagogue that has to raise money, I am well aware our donors often have other charitable priorities, and they tend to give a small percentage of their charitable money to Jewish causes. But look, this giving pledge is an amazing event. A bunch of billionaires have decided to actually commit to giving away at least half their money. This is tzedakah on a magnificent scale and pretty spectacular. This is exactly what Judaism has advocated throughout history, everywhere, in every part of our tradition. We should celebrate this with bells on. And that 13 out of the 40 mega-mega donors taking the giving pledge are Jews, it's phenomenal. I don't know how to say this without making it sound a little bit like all Jews are rich, a terrible stereotype which is tremendously far from the case. But it is stunning that a third of the billionaires giving away most of their fortunes are Jewish. In other news, the conservative movement will unveil a new High Holy Day prayer book this year, the Machzor Lev Shalem, now in production. This is the first new High Holy Day prayer book for the conservative movement in America since the so-called R.A. Machzor, edited by Rabbi Jules Harlow, surfaced in 1972. I still haven't gotten my copy yet, but I'm looking forward to a new and I hope interesting, insightful, and useful prayer book. Perhaps it might even serve to bring some freshness to a conservative movement looking for new direction these days. And Oscar-winning director Oliver Stone apologized for saying in an interview that the Jewish lobby controls Washington's foreign policy and that Hitler's actions should be put into context. As we reported last week on Too Jewish, in an interview with the Sunday Times, Oliver Stone had also said, "Jewish domination of the media prevents an honest discussion about the Holocaust." Well, Stone said in a statement released the day after his remarks were published in the British newspaper, "In trying to make a broader historical point about the range of atrocities the Germans committed against many people, I made a clumsy association about the Holocaust, for which I am sorry and I regret." Ilan Steinberg, vice president of the American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors and Their Descendants, was among the Jewish organizational and Israeli officials condemning the remarks. Steinberg said of Stone's apology that it was necessary and we accept it, but whether he acted out of sincerity or as a desperate response to the moral outcry at his comments is an open question. He must be judged by his future words and deeds, as all of us must. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our outstanding guest this morning, Bill Van Esfeld. He's a human rights watcher, researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories based in Jerusalem. Bill, the very term occupied Palestinian territories sets up a red flag for some Jewish groups. For others, it's a kind of a normative thing. Do you have to be extremely careful in sort of the language that you use?
Language is a huge issue, especially around this conflict. It can get out of hand very quickly. So maybe I'll just try and stay as specific as possible on your question about the term occupied territories. There's nothing illegal about an occupation per se. And again, I apologize for being legalistic here, but that's sort of the basis of what we talk about.
You are actually a lawyer, unless I mistake myself.
Yes. That's right. That's right, I am. So the term occupied territories or the term occupation is just a term in international laws of armed conflict. And it just means that one country or group goes into a territory that it didn't previously control. And then it is so successful there militarily that it actually begins to control what goes on there. So that's an occupation. And so, you know, the West Bank is an occupied territory. For example. So there's no sort of moral bad aspect to the term occupation. What we do when we talk about Israel's occupation is we just say, okay, well, there's a body of laws that govern how you're supposed to do an occupation, how you're supposed to conduct yourself. So you can, and this, for example, is why Human Rights Watch thinks that the settlements are a bad idea, not for moral reasons, but because it's sort of written in the law, in the Geneva Conventions, that you're not supposed to transfer your own civilian population into a territory that you occupy, because the idea is that, well, you hold on to that territory for as long as you need to for your security reasons or for whatever else, but you're not supposed to fundamentally change the way things work there. And so that would be the basis of our opposition to the settlements. But again, it's a very legally based opposition. We try and stay away from language of morality and ethics, although that sounds rather strange, I know. But we try and stay away from it because if you start talking morality, well, you never really win any arguments because each side is going to have its own moral arguments that will justify suicide bombing or launching rockets or whatever. And to that, you just say, well, sorry, it's just against the law. Launching rockets or deliberately killing civilians is a war crime, and you can't do it no matter how you feel about, you know, Israel's horrible occupation. You just can't do it. So if you try and stick to the law that, in the end, in the very long run, can win you some tactical fights.
It's a difficult fight always working for human rights in the world. We spoke a little bit about Hamas, and I think you basically said it's just been a disaster for human rights in Gaza. To change the focus, let's look at the West Bank a little, and which is not controlled by Hamas, but by Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. How do human rights stack up there?
Well, it's not... It's a difficult question to sort of compare and contrast, you know, and we often don't do that sort of thing. We don't do rankings of countries in the way that other groups like Freedom House does rankings of countries or Transparency International. What we try and do is just say, what are some of the worst things that this group is doing that it shouldn't be doing? And then we'll just report on them regardless of what anyone else is doing. So the Palestinian Authority, I think the biggest concern for me right now, or for Human Rights Watch right now, would be the way the security services there, which, you know, just run roughshod over whatever they want to. Supposedly they're under the control of the court system, the civil court system that was set up by the Palestinian Authority, but in reality they have just carte blanche to do whatever they want. And they are, you know, you can be arrested on very, you know, suspicion of just looking at somebody the wrong way. You can then be, if you're lucky and you have a good lawyer, you can get a court order for your release because there's no justification for imprisoning you. Then, if you're unlucky and you've been picked up by a security service that doesn't like you, well, they might comply with a court order and release you, but then they'll pick you up again and rearrest you 10 minutes later. Or they'll drop you off on a street corner, but they've called their buddies in another security service and say, hey, you should go get this guy. So they're sort of formally complying with the rule of law, but in fact they're just blatantly flouting it because they're releasing you and then immediately rearresting you, maybe on, you know, supposedly new charges or something like that, or they're just getting another agency to arrest you so, you know, the court ruling supposedly doesn't apply to them. So arbitrary detention is one thing, and it's just a way that the Palestinian Authority is really keeping a firm lid on any potential disagreements with its policies. And those disagreements could come from people who want it to be much, much more to the left and anti-Israel, or you know, for all sorts of other reasons, people who are concerned about corruption in the PA or anything. That's one issue, is arbitrary detention and arrest. Another issue, of course, is what happens to you once you are arrested. And as you might think, if you've got a group of security services that are running around above the law, well, they're going to start torturing people. And that continues to happen. Surprising good news last year, right after Ramadan, the big, you know, the hugely important Muslim holiday, a few people had been basically tortured to death in 2009, and it seems like the Palestinian Authority got very embarrassed by this, and an order was sent down by the Minister of Interior, Salam Fayyad, saying, don't torture people, you know, stop being evil, basically, and incidents of torture fell off for a few months. Now, the problem is that torture is picking up again, and what we learned from that, I think, is that you can send down an order saying stop torturing people. You can reassign some of the security officers who were involved in torture. You can, you know, demote them or suspend them or transfer them. But if you don't actually criminally sanction them, none of these guys were prosecuted. None of these guys really were made an example of to say, look, the law applies to you as well. Torture is not just a bad thing that we think is bad on Monday, but maybe it's not so bad on Tuesday. Torture is prohibited all the time. And that didn't happen, and so now we're seeing torture go back up again.
Because, of course, the same security personnel are still in place.
Exactly. Some of them get, you know, people who have... We know of a case of a security officer who was implicated in torture. He was so flagrantly in violation of Palestinian law that he was actually demoted and transferred. And then we found him doing the same job in another city. So that, if you talk to an average Palestinian, you know, they will certainly talk about the problems they see in the occupation, but they'll also talk about very much the problems with, you know, law enforcement that are above the law.
It is always easier to report human rights violations if you know about them. Is it easier to do your work? Do you tend to end up focusing more in Human Rights Watch on open societies where you can find abuses rather than more closed societies which are harder to penetrate?
That's an excellent question, and it's something we struggle with a lot. The way in the Middle East division of Human Rights Watch that we're structured is that an individual researcher like me would normally be given one closed country and one more open country, so that you can kind of divide your time between the two of them and, you know, do your best on both fronts, taking into account the frustrations of working on a closed country. So, for example, we have someone who works on Syria and on Lebanon, Lebanon being relatively open, Syria being very closed. And he just released a very scathing report about the first 10 years in power of the current ruler of Syria, Bashar Assad. And the regime there has just missed every opportunity to make incremental and feasible steps towards human rights reforms. And that report got a lot of press. It was difficult for him to do the report. He's been working on it for years. But, you know, it got out there. Another researcher works on Egypt and Libya, Egypt being relatively more open, Libya being relatively more closed. She managed, amazingly, to get a press conference in Tripoli in which she, you know, as we do, slammed the government, but actually brought a few people out of the woodwork to start talking very courageously about what the Libyan regime is doing to them. So for me, I'm in a little bit of a different position Israel.
Gaddafi must be slipping or something. That's extraordinary.
Well, that's a fascinating situation because one of his sons, I think the second son, is, you know, he went to the London School of Economics. He's talking the talk of being a very pro-Western, pro-reform kind of person. He sponsored Human Rights Watch to go in there and do this press conference. It could not have happened without the approval of somebody very high up.
Sure.
So now the question is he going to be able to follow through? You know, are other things going to get in the way? Will he even assume power? We don't know. But anyway, not to avoid the question on Israel, this is a very serious question that we do get a lot. You know, we focus criticism against Israel. Isn't that just because it's so hard for us to get in to other countries that are doing things that are even worse than Israel? I mean, isn't Israel a victim of its own openness, its own democracy, by allowing us to report there relatively freely, and then we come out and slam it when we should be focusing more of our attention on, you know, China or just other countries in the region.
North Korea or whomever, right?
Right, exactly. And that's a criticism we take seriously. I mean, I just invite your listeners to go to the website and, you know, check out how much reporting we do try to do on closed countries, regardless of the difficulties of getting in there. But on Israel, I think it's not necessarily a problem of Israel being victimized by its success as a democracy. I think this is what democracies do. We release more reports criticizing the United States government than we do on any other government around the world, not because the U.S. is necessarily the worst human rights abuser, but because this is the way civil society functions in a good functioning democracy. You know, you open yourself up for criticism, not because groups want to tear you down, or because it's necessarily a campaign of delegitimization against you and you've just foolishly opened the door to that, but because you can learn things from NGOs if you're a government. You can learn that there are certain policies you're pursuing that don't make you any safer, that don't make the country function any better, and that result in unnecessary suffering that could cause, you know, further resentment and danger to you down the road. So why not listen to those NGOs and continue the good policy of being relatively open?
I want to thank Bill Van Esvelt of Human Rights Watch for a tremendous visit here on Too Jewish. What's the website to go to for more information?
www.hrw.org.
hrw.org. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
One of the great experiences in Jewish life is the privilege and pleasure of seeing a new Torah completed. The Linda Nadel Centennial Torah of Temple Emmanuel, celebrating the 100th anniversary year of Arizona's first Jewish congregation, will reach its Siyum dedication ceremony on Sunday, August 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Temple Emmanuel. During this unique celebration, the scribe of the Torah scroll, Rabbi Shmuel Miller, will fill in the final letters of the Centennial Torah on the last section of parchment in Deuteronomy, the final book of the Torah. It's a dramatic, amazing moment. There'll be lots of celebratory music and ceremony and refreshments for all. This once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see the writing of a new Torah completed is open to everyone at no charge. For more information, call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501. Temple is located at 225 North Country Club Road, near Broadway. Join us for the Centennial Torah Siyum on Sunday, August 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Temple Emmanuel.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be the highly controversial pro-Palestinian activist Adam Shapiro, an American Jew who made Aliyah and married a Palestinian woman. It's a weird and very interesting story, and he's about as controversial a figure as you will encounter here. That's next week on Too Jewish. Don't miss it. Our playout this morning comes from the reggae hip-hop star Matis Yahu, who will be here in Tucson August 16th. It's called What I'm Fighting For. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
What I'm fighting for is worth far more than silver and gold. What I'm fighting for is a chance to unite the past. With a bravos coming home at last, fighting together for life. Sons and daughters of Abraham, lay down to a higher command. Don't be tricked by the acts of man. God's wisdom revealed in a holy plan. A chance to unite the past. With a bravos coming fighting together for light.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.